Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 3rd, 1996. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Jim Farrell. Today's session number is 2 and is titled Alarming: The Complexity of Clocks. Let's listen in.
My name is Jim Farrell, and this session is part of a series that I'm working on called The Moral Ecology of Everyday Life. This particular one is called Alarming: The Complexity of Clocks. As far as biblical scholars can tell, there were no alarm clocks in the Garden of Eden. There was morning and evening of the 7 days of creation, but no alarm clocks. It's alarming to think about an alarm clock. Normally, I notice it just twice a day. I see it at night and hear it in the morning. I glance at it as I climb into bed to see how late I've stayed up and to gauge quickly how much rest I might get. 6 or 7 hours later, it bleeps until Barb turns it off. It's on her side of the bed. It signals the beginning of my day, but it signifies much more. Today, I'd like to take a few minutes to talk about the moral ecology of an alarm clock, to consider the problem of invisible complexity, which is a term that we started with last time, trying to see what are the invisible things that are going on in our everyday lives in using something like an alarm clock, to see the problem of invisible complexity involved in waking up to an alarm, to think through the social traps of our social construction of time, and to wake up to our complicity in the complexities of American time. My alarm clock is a Spartus model 1158-61. You'd be fascinated to know this. Produced by the Spartus Corporation of Louisville, Mississippi. It's made in China, and so connects me, even in my sleep, to international markets, trade deficits, and possible protectionism. It also connects me to people working long hours for wages I would consider scandalously low under conditions that are scandalously primitive in a country with scandalous human rights policies. But I am usually ignorant of this, and so I sleep right through my complicity with these cultural patterns. Until I began to write this paper, I was ignorant in the conventional sense that I did not know where my alarm was made. The invisible complexity of American markets covered my complicity. Now I am ignorant in a different way. Now I just ignore what I know, and I still sleep soundly. It's an electric alarm clock, so it depends on power produced by Northern States Power in Minnesota, in its coal-fired generators or nuclear reactors. More than 40% of Minnesota's electrical power is supplied by nuclear energy, so I am voting while I sleep for the continuation of nuclear power and by extension of the nuclear fuel cycle. I am exposing miners to cancer and future generations to radioactive waste. But the coal-powered portion of my electric alarm is not clean either. Coal-fired generators contribute sulfur dioxide to the air, which causes acid rain to fall on eastern Canada and New England. But I ignore this, and I sleep right through the ecological impact of my alarm. And I haven't said anything about the components that go into it, but you can imagine that there are also ecological effects of those components as well. It's a digital clock, and so it has all of the modernistic associations that digital displays have in a culture increasingly infatuated with computers. The digits run in 2 12-hour sequences with a tiny red dot denoting the difference between forenoon and afternoon. The 2 12s make 24, giving me time abstracted and objectified, and marking me as one of those humans who believe that 24 hours constitute a day, an absolutely arbitrary idea, but one which most of us never think about. These 2 dozen hours structure our days and create a framework for cultural relations. And that's real important. I mean, that's one of the real important things about time. All of us showed up here at 3:45 this afternoon because time works in exactly that way. It's a great way of coordinating fairly large groups of people. This clock and others like it are signs of this social construction of reality. And I want to read to you just a little bit here now from Bill McKibben's The Age of Missing Information. This is a book, as I mentioned last time, where he compares he watched all 105 channels of a cable system for 24 hours, which seems to me it's a wonder that he was able to get words to paper after that. And he went for a 24-hour walk on a mountain, and he's comparing the kinds of information that's generated by these two experiences. And so here's a section from the section that he calls Late Afternoon. The question, what time is it, draws a different answer on the mountain and in front of the TV. And the answers, far from being frivolous, have great environmental, social, personal meaning. The mountain and the television aren't so much in different time zones as in different dimensions. Human beings, of course, have perceived time in 2 main ways, linearly and cyclically. Either history advances forward through time or the world repeats itself, repeats endless cycles. These different conceptions are rich. They've spawned religions and philosophies for millennia. But in truth, human beings were always exposed to both. Any honest Buddhist has a personal sense of the course of his own current life, and even aggressively linear Christianity, with its sense of an approaching climax to history, is nonetheless soaked with the imagery of the seasons. In the last 100 years, though, and more all the time, the linear view is stomping out the other set of information, which is as old as man. Take just one example, the length of the daylight hours. At the latitude where I live, nightfall varies by 3 or 4 hours over the course of the year. And a heck of a lot more of that in Minnesota, as I recall. In December, it's dark at 4:30. At the end of June, the light lingers late into the evening. This is one of the elemental pieces of information the world provides us. In other species, it triggers dormancy and hibernation, the coloring of leaves and the gathering of food. Human beings always used to be sensitive to it. Even after hours were invented, for millennia, they were seasonal hours. This is something I didn't know until I read this book. That is, daylight was divided into 12 hours, as was dark. In the Northern Hemisphere, the period between, say, 1 and 2 p.m. was much longer during the summer than it was during the winter. This piece of information proved too subtle for the mechanical clock, which in the 13th century began to smooth out time. But at least people still noticed the long, slow shift, felt it in their bones like the ancient pagans who built their elaborate monuments to mark the equinoxes and solstices. The spread of artificial light and the ability to continue all activity around the clock eroded this sense much more radically than the clock. Now we hardly even recognize the change. If it's pitch dark or sunny out, the evening news still comes on at 7, and prime time, which is America's most important time, starts at 8. That's the part I wanted to read, so I can pass this around. But you get a sense from that of the social construction of time. The time has been different, and that it could again be different if we chose. Anyway, back to my alarm clock. It has a snoozer, which is a device that I have never been able to understand. I dislike the sound of my alarm, and I have never wanted to hear it twice in one morning. But many people take great psychological pleasure in the extra, and I put that in quotations, minute of sleep that a snoozer allows. The second section is called work time. Most people set the alarm on days when they have to go to work, and Barb and I are no different. We assume, as most Americans do, that we must be on time for work. Some of us, in fact, punch time clocks as we go to work, but for almost all of us, punctuality is a virtue in the workplace where we sell our time for money. In my life, work is the only event that I set an alarm for, which gives some sense, I think, of the centrality of work in the culture. I'll be talking more about that next week. In terms of time, Americans are the world's workaholics. Only the Japanese work more, but while their work week is still shrinking, ours is increasing. In the last 20 years, Americans have annually added about 9 hours to their time at work. This doesn't sound like much, but it's almost an extra month of work in the last 20 years. We are what Juliet Shore calls overworked Americans, and we work what she calls long hour jobs. The time that we devote to work is time not devoted to other things, so that we have less time for family, for sociability, for leisure, for lifelong learning, for sleep. Studies show that a majority of Americans get 60 to 90 minutes less sleep than they should, and experts say that if you need an alarm clock, you're probably not getting enough sleep. Work time is mandatory in America's social construction of reality, but still it is a social construction. We have chosen to spend our time at work. Since 1948, the productivity of American workers has doubled, which means that we have had the choice to work less or consume more. We could have chosen the 4-hour day, or the 20-hour week, the 6-month vacation, or a sabbatical every other year. But as Alan Derning shows in the book that I passed around, How Much is Enough?, we have chosen to consume more, with all the ecological consequences of that consumption. And often when we think about cutting back, we think about, oh, it would be a radical reduction if we lived more simply. But if we simply cut back to 1948, we would have cut back by half. And at least as I read 1948, it wasn't all that primitive. It was still sort of modern. We forget that time, clock time, is a relatively recent invention. In America, for example, the alarm clock dates only from the 1870s, when the Seth Thomas Clock Company in Connecticut began to market its wind-up device. largely irrelevant to agricultural populations who regulated their activity by the sun and the seasons. Clock time was applied to coordinate the activities of people at work in industrial production or bureaucratic organizations. The clock, not the steam engine, insisted Lewis Mumford, is the key machine of the modern industrial age. It is a piece of power machinery whose product is seconds and minutes. In manufacturing such a product, Neil Postman confirms, the clock has the effect of disassociating time from human events and thus nourishes the belief in an independent world of mathematically measurable sequences. Moment to moment, it turns out, is not God's conception or nature's. It is man conversing with himself about and through a piece of machinery he created. And this phrase, disassociating time from human events, is an important one. It used to be that in many cultures and in primitive cultures, if you wanted to tell somebody a certain amount of time, you would tell them, I'll meet you in a rice boiling. And since in that particular culture, people were familiar with how long it took for rice to boil, you had a time sequence. But the time was associated to a human activity and not abstracted the way we do it, saying, I'll meet you in 45 minutes. During the 19th century, too, this idea of time was popularized, and people began to carry small clocks called watches so that they could be on time. The 19th century in America is a wonderful time to watch time catching hold of people. Railroads have a lot to do with this because railroads needed to coordinate the time. And the time zones we have actually are really a gift to railroads because until the standard times were created in the 1880s, each city, noon at each city was exactly when the sun was directly overhead, which meant that you could have 100 different noons in any one time zone. And so it was real hard to coordinate a railroad schedule and to say exactly what time the railroad would be arriving at any time. And so the railroads actually told the nation, you're going to have to get your act together so we can get our act together and let you know when we'll be there. And the 19th century is also the time when you get town halls with clock towers on them, marking the centrality of time to them. And the very popular use of factory whistles. When a factory came into town and the whistle would blow at noon, that was something, a matter of rejoicing that progress has come to River City or wherever it was. A broader definition of watch, as I mentioned the other day, is the act or fact of keeping awake, especially of keeping awake and alert in order to look after, protect, or guard. In this sense, a watch invites us to look at the alarming complexities of watches and alarm clocks and to see our complicity in the cultural production of common sense that they represent. This is a phrase I like a lot from a guy named Jeff Smith, the cultural production of common sense. Common sense is, you know, we know what it is. It's just common sense that you do this or that. But common sense is culturally constructed. And sometimes it's culturally constructed by minorities and imposed on majorities. So that it, in fact, is not common. It's sort of uncommon sense that somebody wants us to believe. It is common sense, for example, to think that we have time to save or spend because Americans have a proprietary sense of time. We treat it like property, like money. For as Benjamin Franklin told us, time is money. In a capitalist society, the abstraction of time has become commodified. We save time, we buy time with labor-saving devices, and then once we have acquired time, we spend time with families and friends. One study showed that Americans use about 10.5 hours taking care of bodily needs, eating, sleeping, and personal care in a day, 7.5 hours at work, and about 0.5 hour of child care. This left 6 hours of discretionary time, two of which we use watching TV, I think I'm talking about also next week. 1.5 hours in casual social interaction, 50 minutes in travel, not including commuting, 30 minutes in resting or miscellaneous leisure. This left time for an average 12 minutes of study, 10 minutes of religion, 8 minutes of sports, 6 minutes of entertainment and cultural events, and 6 minutes for voluntary organizations. This is the way that we divide up our time. Of course, not in any given day. We don't do it exactly that way. You know, sort of, I'm going out to play 6 minutes of sports would be a little bit ridiculous. That's an average. But the time we spend tells us a lot about what we value. When we say we don't have time to do something that we ought to do, what we mean is that we have culturally constructed our time so that these things are not priorities. If we really thought that religion was as important as TV, we would culturally contrive to devote 2 hours a day to it. But it's not as important culturally, so we don't. Time gives us a calculus of utility, partly because of the time and motion studies of people like Frederick Winslow Taylor, who is if you know the book Cheaper by the Dozen, he was a guy that worked with Frank Gilruth and was really the pioneer of the time and motion studies at the turn of the century. We define efficiency as the amount of work you can accomplish in a given amount of time. And recently, we are restructuring workplaces to become even more efficient. This is called downsizing. Now, this is, again, efficiency can be defined in various ways. We've chosen, because of our time fixation, to define it as the amount of work done in a certain amount of time. But it could also be defined as the amount of fossil energy used to accomplish a certain kind of job. We don't do that. We don't pay any attention to fossil energy in terms of efficiency, although I think more and more as we become ecologically conscious that will happen. We even have type A personalities with a strange sense of urgency of what needs to be done. Even those of us, I'm not a type A person, even those of us with type B or Q or Z personalities often seem stressed by time, wishing that there were more than 24 hours in a day. A recent Northwestern National Life Insurance survey showed that more than half of American workers feel highly stressed. Highly stressed. The study also showed Americans suffering from stress-related maladies, 62% feeling exhausted, 62% angry or anxious, 60% with muscle pain, 45% with headaches, 45% unable to sleep. I qualify on all of those things. There's also been a feminization of what sociologists call this time famine. The handout suggests, for example, that while Americans average 22 hours of leisure a week, women average 5 hours less than men. Now, I don't think this is because women value leisure less. It's largely because of what Arlie Hochschild calls the second shift, in which women perform most of the unpaid caring work of family and community. Even in households where both spouses work full-time, women on the average do more housework, and generally a lot more, than men. Usually the divisions are about 70-30 or 80-20 between men and women. Women who work also find themselves responsible for child care, the mommy track. Why is there no daddy track, we might ask. And increasingly for aging parents, the daughter track. So while the time famine weighs heavily on all of us, it weighs especially heavy on women. Cultural patterns that include rigid temporal norms, the length of the timing of the workday, for example, a linear life course model, so a strictly sequential kind of movement through education and career and family, and gender distributions of work all affect this kind of gendered politics of time in America. But again, we're all stressed by work, or a lot of us are. Even with these symptoms, we generally choose not to change, but to cope with the social construction of work. And what goes on here is we collectively create a social problem, but we ask individuals to solve it on their own. Because of our cultural emphasis on individualism, we look for individual cures to social pathology. And I think we do this in all kinds of areas, but particularly in this one. Consequently, we now have a whole industry of time management. Time management is the way that you tell individuals to cope with a social problem, or to cure a social problem by managing their time. It's not our fault that things are screwed up and you don't have enough time. It's your fault, so get with it. Books and tapes tell us how to use our time efficiently, and many products help us to schedule our time effectively. I use a book called The Uncalendar, which requires me to number all of the days of the year. It's just a book that comes with kind of spaces, but the spaces are about the right size for what I do. I don't do all that much, and so they don't have to be very big. You know, I just have to list a couple things a day. But there are many more sophisticated devices. One of them is called day timers, and I've seen this in stores. And man, you can schedule down to the quarter of a second in that, maybe even in new versions to the nanosecond. At St. Olaf, at the beginning of the school year, each student receives a publication called The Book, which helps us to teach students how to fit into the busyness of American life. The book includes academic deadlines, sports and entertainment events, and it invites students to schedule their frantic lives in the interstices of these pre-programmed events. And in a way, what we teach students at college, I think, is how to deal with stress and also how to have it. We first of all generate it for them, and then we tell them, you know, here's some ways to deal with it, like time management. And we do offer seminars at St. Olaf on time management for students. It would never occur to the faculty that we could reduce the amount of stuff that we're requiring of students, you know, because that would be a structural solution to the structural problem. Instead, it's the students' problem, and they have to cope with it. Ads for new products like microwave ovens and cellular phones and fax machines also assure us that these technologies will allow us to master the time we are allotted. US West sells cellular phones that are for making the most of your time. at a Watts number designated 1-800-BUY-TIME. It's interesting in this regard how we feel personally responsible for the lack of time in our lives when society structures so many of the time-wasting features of it. Commuting is a good example of such a social trap. Americans waste billions of hours and tremendous amounts of gas getting to and from work. But if we structured spatial arrangements differently, if we rethought the separate zoning of business and residential space, if we adjusted the times that we all go to work, all of which would be social solutions to a social problem, we might begin to redeem the time now spent swearing in and swearing at cars on the highway. Now, the average American at work spends 9 hours a week on the freeways commuting, and that adds up to about 3 weeks a year of time spent in car commuting. In these time-saving products and many others, we buy convenience, packaged in a multiplicity of forms. But what, in fact, is convenience and what does it cost? The cost of convenience, in many cases, is consideration, and the cost of consideration is often quality and environmental degradation. We conventionally think of these time-saving devices as a good thing, but E.F. Schumacher, the author of Small is Beautiful, offers as his first law of economics that, quote, the amount of real leisure a society enjoys tends to be in inverse proportion to the amount of labor-saving machinery it employs. When the English first encountered the Indians in New England, for example, they considered the Indians lazy because they worked, as most hunter-gatherer groups do, only 15 or 20 hours a week, providing for themselves, with the rest of the time spent in leisure, in community festivals, and just kind of hanging out. This is what Marshall Solins calls Zen affluence, having much by wanting little. And the Indians looked right back and said, these English people are nuts. Here we are in a land where you can provide for yourself without doing much at all. And these people are working like crazy as if something wonderful was going to happen. And the something wonderful that the English thought was going to happen was that they were going to get rich or they were going to get wealthy. But so we are descendants of the English because we allot a great proportion of our time to work and very little to socializing or social issues. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about leisure time. In the United States, many of us spend time at work so that we can have free time or time of our own in the evenings or on weekends. Free time is free of the obligations and duties of work or school or church or other formal organizations. Free time is, I think, opposed to slave time, the time in which we are bound to someone else, although we never use that term. It might be a useful term to sort of start. Free time is personal time and is part of the expressive individualism of American culture. Time of our own is a time when we can be ourselves, time when we can use the creative capacities that often stand idle at work. Time of our own is the socially constructed compensation for the alienated work which we have socially constructed for ourselves. Instead of changing these social constructions so that work is fulfilling to human beings, we commute to the job in cars with bumper stickers that say, I live for weekends. There's a wonderful book called Waiting for the Weekend, which is a history of weekends and how they grew and have become, in a way, commercialized in the 20th century. They've grown for a long time. Weekends were there for a long time, but they've become a peculiar sort of thing in America in the 20th century. And one of the things that he shows is that free time is not free of cultural definitions. If the week belongs to work, then the weekend belongs to Michelob. That was a slogan of maybe 10 years ago. Or AMF, which is the people that invent bowling stuff. They once ran ads saying, we invented weekends. Or whoever is trying to market fun morality to us. A great deal of American consumer culture depends on the cultural convention that you deserve a break today, or it's Miller time. And that leisure means the consumption of leisure products. And if you start looking around, you see the number of ways that weekends are sold to us and commodified in various ways. Free time is time without an alarm clock. We must rise on weekdays, but many of us sleep in on weekends, a time out of time in American culture. Now, one of the days of the weekend is Sunday, which used to be known in Judeo-Christian cultures as the Sabbath. The Sabbath used to be a sacred time, a time of rest and reflection, a time when Christians considered how to redeem the time. With the Sabbath, people made time to listen to the sacred and to apply the wisdom of holiness to their everyday lives. It reflected the notion set out in the story of Genesis that God had created time out of eternity for the purposeful use of her creatures and then commanded the creatures to use it wisely. Failing that initial wisdom in the Garden of Eden, the creatures were required to participate in the work of redemption by redeeming the time assigned to them to build the kingdom of God on earth. Although many religious Americans still attend church services on Sunday, we lack that earlier sense of sacred time and of redeeming the time. Where in earlier Christian culture told time by the Angelus bells, they were bells that rang at dawn and at noon and at dusk, and they were a call to prayer. And so the whole community, whatever you were doing, you're supposed to stop and come to prayer. And in fact, the word clock comes from the French cloche, which means bell. So even when talking about an alarm clock, what we're really talking about is something that goes back to that older sense of time as a sort of sacred intervals of time where we come to reflect on what we're doing and to see it within a cosmological framework rather than within the narrow framework of the particular thing that we're up to. Anyway, that was a more sacred sense of time. We're more secular, of or pertaining to the temporal rather than the spiritual, than sacred. Like weekends, vacations are also a way of changing the time. Many of us are here at Holden to redeem the time of our lives. But I don't have time to tell you about time. The alarm clock or any clock tells you, or most American clocks tell you about only present time. So it's, you know, it's 6:45 on my alarm clock, and then the next thing it shows is 6:46, and 6:45 is just gone until it rolls around again in the evening. So it tells me one social construction of time, and it helps me to ignore other constructions of time. Clocks are the embodiment of American presentism. They tell us about today. Some clocks and watches even have a calendar feature, but it doesn't connect today to yesterday or tomorrow. Yesterday, my clock presumes, is history, and tomorrow is science fiction. By ignoring yesterday, the clock keeps us from being mindful of the ways that we are a creation of the past. All of the ideas and institutions that we're going to be talking about this week are the creations of dead people, clocks included. We are the incarnation of the past, and we are responsible to it. We need to conserve the best of the past, but too often we think, as the aphorism has it, that today is just the first day of the rest of our lives. Wendell Berry's poem, At a Country Funeral, is a lovely reminder of the potency of the past in our lives. In this poem, a farmer has died, and people have come home for the funeral, and Berry describes the funeral. Now the old dead wait in the open coffin for the blood kin to gather, come home for one last time, to hear old men whose tongues bear an essential topography speak memories doomed to die. But our memory of ourselves, hard-earned, is one of the land's seeds, as a seed is the memory of the life of its kind in its place, to pass on into life the knowledge of what has died. What we owe the future is not a new start, for we can only begin with what has happened. That sentence is a heretical sentence. Americans don't believe that at all. We always want new things, the new frontier, the new Cheerios, the new Kix, the new washing detergent. We believe in the new frontier, the new deal, all that thing. Let me read that sentence again then. What we owe the future is not a new start, for we can only begin with what has happened. We owe the future the past, the long knowledge that is the potency of time to come. That makes a man's grave a rich furrow. The community of knowing in common is the seed of our life in this place. There is not only no better possibility, there is no other. Except for chaos and darkness, the terrible ground of the only possible new start. And so as the old die and the young depart, where shall a man go who keeps the memories of the dead, except home again, as one would go back after a burial, faithful to the fields, lest the dead die a second and more final death. It's also true that my alarm clock doesn't tell me about future time. And I'm going to skip some stuff here. In a way, Americans in this culture ask, what has the future ever done for me? Or there's a bumper sticker in Minnesota that says, I'm spending my children's inheritance. To some extent, this is the kind of view of the future that we have. And this conception of the future also appears in our cultural neglect of children, who are the poorest Americans. Children are poorer than any other group in America. Our ancestors, however, had an idea of the future that they expressed by the term posterity, and it relates to the 4th of July. They also tended to think further ahead than many contemporary Americans do. When asked why he was involved in the politics of the American Revolution, John Adams, for example, answered that, "I must study politics and war that my sons may have liberty to study mathematics and philosophy. My sons ought to study mathematics and philosophy, geography, natural history, and naval architecture, navigation, commerce, and agriculture in order to give their children a right to study painting, poetry, music, architecture, statuary, tapestry, and porcelain. And what you get in this is a sort of sense of you know, three or four generations that he's thinking ahead of why he's doing what he's doing. And the most interesting thing about this quotation is that it works out this way. I think I missed a sentence in here because there's supposed to be diplomacy in here as well. His son was John Quincy Adams, who was the first minister to Russia from the young United States and then president of the United States. And then even more impressive than that, after he was president, he thought, I could still serve this country. And so he was part of the House of Representatives after that. John Quincy Adams' son was Charles Francis Adams, who was involved in business and particularly with the railroads in the Northeastern corridor. And Charles Francis Adams' two sons were Henry Adams, the first president of the American Historical Association, and Brooks Adams, both of whom were intensely interested in the arts at the end of the 19th century. Very few of us have that sense of the future of posterity, of thinking ahead at all. In fact, in the late 70s, Jimmy Carter commissioned a study called Global 2000, which was to think ahead 21 years. And he was roundly criticized for doing something so stupid as thinking that far ahead. And we tend to think mainly in terms of, I think, 2 and 4 years ahead at most, because that's the election cycle that we have in American politics. I think Jimmy Carter will be known as the first of the 21st century presidents, because he was addressing in his term all of the issues that will be important when people are finally confronted with the necessities of doing that sort of thing. We might also think about biological time, and here you might think either about circadian rhythms of our bodies and the ways in which our artificial time works with that, or you might sort of take as an index of time something biological or geological. And Wendell Berry likes to take as an index of time the amount of time that it takes to make an inch of topsoil, which is about 500 years. And his argument basically is that if you're doing anything that doesn't allow you to replenish an inch of topsoil for every inch you take away, and that's going to take 500 years, then you're not on time. You're out of time. You've screwed up time, because you're not living with the biological time that you're assigned. And then I want to talk lastly about God's time. We believe in general in progress in the United States, and it's hard to argue against it. But Martin Luther King was one important American who did. In his letter from Birmingham jail, he argued against the strangely irrational notion that there is something in the flow of time that will inevitably cure all ills. Actually, he insisted, time itself is neutral. It can be used either destructively or constructively. More and more, I feel that the people of ill will have used time much more effectively than the people of goodwill. We will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the hateful words and actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence of the good people. Human progress never rolls in on wheels of inevitability. Great sentences in American literature. Human progress never rolls in on wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts of people willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the forces of social stagnation. In an almost Puritan sense, King seems to be saying that we need to redeem the time. King's sense that we are co-workers or co-creators with God suggests as well that we exist in what might be called God's time, another dimension of time that doesn't get caught in the liquid crystals of my alarm clock. The time that we measure is only an element of eternity, and the lives that we measure by the clock may also end in immortality or time out of time. So in the broadest sense, what does my alarm clock awaken me to? Normally it awakens me to the routines of my day, which is culturally produced for me. But in a broader sense, an alarm is a warning of danger. And in that sense, my clock sounds an alarm that to everything there is a season and a time and place under heaven. It places us in a context of creation and redemption and alarms us that we seldom take the time to reflect about that fact. It reminds me that my time is a gift from God, that the way I spend my time is my identity and my values. And then, as Karen Christensen says, taking time to consider how you want to spend the time of your life is the first step in home ecology. This ringing alarm also awakens me when I am awake to what it means, to the possibility of conspiring or breathing together, again, wonderfully from the Latin root, to breathe together with God and God's people for a future time in which Christ's promises are fulfilled. That brings me, as Robert Penn Warren says at the end of All the King's Men, out of history and into history and the awful responsibility of time. Thank you for remaining watchful, alert, and awake for the most part. Questions, comments?
I think it's going to be interesting to see in the next 5 years, when they start doing surveys over the last five, how much this downsizing and right-sizing in America has impacted the amount of time people work.
I think it's going to go up more.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons that can happen is that most American workers are now salaried, so the money that we get is not connected to the time we spend. And I'm working from a book of Juliet Shore's called The Overworked American, which is a really wonderful discussion of work in contemporary American culture. She says essentially that for corporations, if they can get one person who's salaried to do more work, that's great. Even if I've got the three of you working on a job, if I can get the three of you to perform enough work to actually count for a fourth person, which is, say, only 13 hours a week additional, that's great because I get the work done and I don't have to pay benefits to anybody. So I save a lot of money by getting people to work what she calls long-hour jobs. And downsizing, to a great extent, is exactly that, trying to get people to increase the amount of time that they spend working. And it has all kinds of deleterious social effects. I mean, downsizing is really horrible for the kinds of community and family that we might want. There are arguments of efficiency for downsizing and of competitiveness in a world market, but there are also ways in which a country as affluent as this can structure regulations so that corporations don't need to downsize like that. And what they need to do there is simply to even the playing field. As they did with something like minimum wage. They simply said corporations can't pay less than this, and so then there was no longer an incentive for corporations to do that. There are lots of ways that politically we can structure work so that it becomes not so time-consuming if we want to, but in many instances, people with power don't have an incentive to want to.
Do you think that there'll ever be a point when people start working so much that after a while the pendulum starts to swing a little?
I think it's swinging already. When you ask people, do you spend too much time at work? Actually, there's a survey that asks people where they'd like to have more time in their lives. And not very many people put that they'd like to have more time for work. Actually, 9% do, and I don't know what they're up to, but most don't. Most people don't want to work more. They want to do other things more. And they're beginning to see the costs of the time that they're putting into work. Surveys show this fairly regularly. The question is whether or not you can take the attitudes that are shown in surveys and put them into some kind of political form. That makes a difference. I think that will happen. The other thing that has to happen sooner or later, sort of given the speed with which Americans do things, probably later, is that we have to start. Actually, when you ask people, what are the things that you most like to do? There are things that take time. There are things like conversations. There are things like hobbies that they're working on, like painting or something like that. They're all things that take time, but they don't take generally materials. Conversations are pretty easy to do without a lot of junk or stuff. And so conversations are ecologically wonderful. Unlike the kinds of things that we do on weekends, which are tend to be commodity loaded. And so ecologically, we will probably get to a place where we have to spend time, sort of quality time with each other, in order to keep us satisfied without the things that satisfy us now, which is to say all the commodities that we get.
We used to play cards and now we watch TV.
Pardon me?
We used to play cards and now we watch TV.
Right. I mean, there are all kinds of things. I talk about this when I talk about TV. But TV, I mean, work has what economists call the opportunity cost, which is to say all the other things that you could be doing when you were at work. And there's an article by Robert Putnam called Bowling Alone, where he talks about the decline of what he calls social capital. Simply, people don't have time to get together in, say, things like this. And his best example of that is bowling leagues. He says there are more people bowling now than there ever have been, but they're not bowling in leagues. And what a league allows you is simply the time to talk to other people when you're bowling, you know, on a regular sort of basis. And he says that creates social capital in any kind of conversation like that, or church conversations, coffee and donuts after a service or something like that. That creates social capital because it sort of reinforces social norms and lets you know that there are other people who care. Television is not very good at that because most people don't talk when they're watching TV. It's considered an intrusion if somebody talks while you're watching TV. And people actually zone out when they watch TV. I said yesterday that 1/5 of Americans say that they can sleep and watch TV at the same time. And I believe that's true. And there are other things that are similar to that. In supermarkets, because you go past all those products so fast, you tend to, your brain actually shifts into another gear, which is kind of a lower gear, and you're less attentive in a supermarket than you are in other instances of your life. And I think, and I suspect that's true in shopping malls too, although I don't know that for sure.
I recently saw a program on sleep deprivation. Apparently, there are vast numbers of people in the United States, especially, that operate on quite a few hours less sleep than they need a week, and especially that concerns us with jobs like, say, being a pilot.
Right.
But I wonder, what wasn't said in this program, if there's any history of how many hours of sleep people got, say, 50 years ago or 100 years ago or 10 years ago as opposed to now. And I wondered, is there some kind of correlation between stress and sleep or stress and not sleep?
That's a great question that I don't know the answer to.
I read something recently that said that prior to electricity, people got 2 hours more sleep per night.
That makes sense to me. When I go camping, I tend to go to sleep when it gets dark and to sleep pretty much until it gets light. So that is more sleep than I get when I'm at home with the lights on.
Could you share your thoughts? You started to talk the other day about the porches and the transition of the porches and when you see the pendulum coming back as far as community and the impact that has?
There's some movement back also in terms of communities. In what are now actually planned communities, Seaside, Florida, is one where every house in the whole place has been designed to be within 1/4 mile of a commercial center or of downtown. Which means that 1/4 mile that people have found is about the limit that people will walk to go anywhere. But they will walk that far, and so the idea is to kind of create pedestrian cultures where people come into contact because they're walking. That can't happen in the car. In our neighborhood, in the winter in Minnesota, I tend to go almost everywhere by car, and my interactions with my neighbors tend to be largely this, you know? But in the summer, when it's kind of nice in Minnesota, and you're out walking, you have these kinds of interactions that are important to what Putnam would call social capital. So there are lots of designers now who are involved in trying to create what they call cluster suburbs or pocket suburbs that are close together, things within walking distance so that you don't need the car within the suburb itself. And then, again, every house within 1/4 mile of mass transit so that people can avoid using cars to go to work. Now, given the patterns of suburbia that have already been created that make us automobile dependent, it will be a long time before those things make a major effect. But at least for me, I think they're really satisfying. One of the places that I like that I think as a cultural critic I'm not supposed to like is Disney World, and I like Disney World because it's a pedestrian place. You come in there to one of the resort hotels, you park your car, and you never move it for a week. We'd say 4 days, I think, the last time we were there. And I tend to be an early riser, and I wake up about 5:30 or 5:45, and you simply can go out and walk. And then you see some really remarkable things. You see the infrastructure of Disney World. At one of the hotels there, I saw them change about 3,000 or 4,000 flowers one morning from red to yellow. And the ones that were there looked great, but they have really kind of an assembly line way of doing flowers in front of the hotel. And I guess my guess is that most of the guests didn't notice at all, but it was just great to watch. I bet they had 20 or 25 people working on that one flower bed, and they would just sort of flip them off the trucks like that. One guy, you should know about this, Doran. He's one of the gardeners here at Holden. We can be efficient like that.
Our new method now.
That's right. But when you get to Disney World, it's a pedestrian space, and I think that's one of the reasons why people have such a good feel about it. Part of it is the kind of contrived friendliness that goes on at Disney World, but part of it is that, in fact, you're in view of people who are walking. Or in Minneapolis, for example, Lake Harriet is the lakes. People walk around the lakes, and that pedestrian space is really important, I think. I see a couple questions in the back here, and then back up front. Jerry?
Do you consider the flip side to the long-hour salaried person with the part-time hourly person? The major employer in Oregon is Fred Meyer, of which 80% of the employees are part-time, benefitless employees.
Right. And this is one of the things that Shore points out in her book, is you have overworked Americans, and you have worked Americans, but then you have underworked and unemployed Americans as well. And so this overwork that we've got could be used by some other people. There are lots of people there who could use the work that we don't want to do, that, you know, beyond the, say, 40 hours or 30 hours or 20 hours, sort of depending on where we decide that we want to do that.
And that's part of the design structure, together with hiring through employment agencies or they hire from temporary
people. Right. And, it's part of that is because of benefits, and the cost of benefits are very high, and because there aren't any kinds of regulations that would make corporations... When there aren't regulations that make corporations do the right thing, in many cases, for economic efficiency, they have to do the wrong thing. So it's a way in which I think that you need to have a kind of social agreement about what you're going to establish as the norms for things, so that corporations can do that. Many of them would like to. Many of them even have programs that are what I consider kind of socially beneficial programs. Like, some people pay people to do volunteer work. Corporations pay people to do volunteer work. And I think that's wonderful, but in an economically competitive market, that gets less and less possible to do. But if you said as a law, the corporations have to pay people to do volunteer work, then it would even things out. And the person and the corporation that doesn't do that socially beneficial thing wouldn't benefit from it. So we had a question over here.
Oh, I was going to respond about the porch issue. I did a study a while back on our urban environmental design and how it affects crime and that type of thing. And one of the main things that we've lost is the front porch that contributes to crime, as well as our loss of socialization, which also contributes to allowing crime in the neighborhoods.
Right. That's great.
I was wondering why people went, like you were saying, that day to the decks in the back of the house. Why the transition from the front porch to the hidden?
Well, I think we are becoming increasingly privatized. And I think that, and I guess I don't know exactly why that's the case. It is a private space at the back of the house. And I don't know why people would choose that privacy. Perhaps just because they haven't thought about...
Cars.
Actually, cars are part of it. Yeah, that's right, to get away from the traffic. And many houses now, at least in where I live, are designed where the garage is the main element of the house. You know?
The garage takes up most of the front yard of our house.
Right.
Mm-hmm. This is sparking out the front porch, too. A community with people on their front porch is also considered by children.
Right.
And I think that kind of breakdown has to do with the way children have to. How many children can just run around in the summer like we used to?
Right.
There's day camp, or there's... this or that.
Right.
So we have to have alarm clocks too.
Right.
When you're on vacation.
Or we fence our individual yards, and then the child has only that amount of range that they can go in. There's a really good book on the history of American homes and on the design of American domestic architecture by Dolores Hayden, called Redesigning the American Dream. And what she suggests doing, say, in urban areas, is simply turning blocks, a city block, inside out. And having all of the access of cars be off the street, and then turning the houses around so that essentially in the middle there you have a public common green that is the public space for a whole block. And that would be an area where kids would be free to go, people could do gardening, that sort of thing. And another thing that she suggests is to sort of rezone things. Right now, most single family home places, you can't have what are called mother-in-law apartments or something like that, granny apartments or something like that. You can't do that. And she would want to have that so that you could have more intergenerational multiplicity in a neighborhood. And that would be good for kids and for grandparents and for families in many ways. But again, zoning laws tell us we can't do that. And zoning laws now tell us that you can't have a mix of business and commercial areas and residential areas. They have to be residential or commercial or business. So zoning, I mean, we haven't just accidentally gotten to where we are. We've had laws that get us there, and we will need laws to get us out of it.
Don't you think barbecues have a lot to do with putting people in the backyard?
Yeah, I mean, barbecues to some extent, although where I grew up we had big front porches and then we had bonfires in the backyard, and the one did detract from the other. On the night that you weren't sitting on the front porch listening to the ball game on the radio, you could then be in the back doing the barbecue.
The front porch, with the way it did, for two reasons. One is the square footage cost for homes precluded putting a front porch on. Secondly, the use of air conditioning. That the builders took a look at this, and the buyers.
Right, that's true. I can't remember the exact statistics on this now, but I think 90% of new American homes now have air conditioning, and air conditioning will operate in the same way to keep people away from each other in the season when they might be outside speaking to each other.
When I was a kid, it didn't seem important. In fact, it seemed terrible. But looking back on it, it was a very important time to me. My sister and I took turns drying dishes. Even number of days was her turn. Odd number of days was my turn. That was part of the time we had with my mother.
Right.
And we would talk and communicate. And we didn't go through that. My kids didn't get it when they were growing up. We had a dishwasher.
Right.
So we had to create other ways. And the TV kind of came along with those
things. Well, I mean, you're onto two different things, I think, here. One is that is the satisfactions of doing work together. It's hard to sell that abstractly. And it's hard to sell that to kids. But it is, in fact, true. There is satisfaction in doing work together rather than doing it alone. So the kind of communal aspect of doing work is real important. The other thing is where we have time to spend time with kids. For me, those conversations occur when I'm chauffeuring them around. Mm-hmm. I live in a suburb where you have to drive to go almost anywhere. And the kids are not, when they come home from school, real talkative. You know, what'd you do in school today? Nothing. Or how was your day? Good. That's it. But in the car, they know we've got a certain amount of time that we're stuck together, and they tend to open up. It's also a place where they don't have to look at me, I think. So I think face-to-face across a table, I must be authoritarian or something like that. But in the car, we're sort of both sitting face the same way, and it seems to work pretty well.
I'm wondering about our sense of time in terms of years, and if there's any significance to the fact, I'm sure there is, that we're entering a millennium. Do you know anything about this? Or I just interests me.
I don't know that people are thinking a whole lot about it yet, because it's a whole 4 years away, and Americans don't think that far into the future. But actually, I don't know what the turn of the millennium will do. It'll be great for advertising, I'll tell you that. And in fact, they're already beginning to advertise cars for the 21st century. So, I mean, there'll be a lot of advertising hype about the change in the millennium, but I'm not sure what substantial we'll get out of that.
Speaking to one historian, and she had all kinds of, I can't repeat what she said correctly, but all kinds of theories about how our angst over nearing a century and how the ends of centuries have always historically brought changes. It was interesting to me, but she had a lot.
Yeah, I mean, there's a French term called fin de siècle, which talks about the end of a century, and ends of centuries tend to be fairly traumatic times. But in the past, they've also tended to coincide with depressions, and so you had other reasons why you might explain the kind of anxiety that people were feeling. And they also tended to be in cultures that were substantially more Christian and apocalyptic than we are. I think we're, in a way, too secular to worry about millennia in ways that people did when they were, sometimes they were expecting the second coming of Christ at the millennium. And that would be a big deal, but I don't think probably most of us think that's going to happen.
Well, speaking of, sorry.
Go ahead.
And then back here.
You ahead first.
I'm sure you heard about all the concerns with all the computer software that everybody's using that is written to keep time automatically until the end of 1999, and then go back to 1900 instead of automatically going.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Billions of dollars to fix it.
We just noticed that now that we're 4 years away.
Are you a pupil? What a great deal. The other thing that the computer is doing is speeding things up. I mean, the nanosecond is becoming a real important piece of time in American culture, and computers will not tend to slow things down and make us more reflective, I think.
Yeah, I'm curious, what factors have allowed people in other countries to have so much more leisure time than we do?
Mandatory vacations. It's true in many European countries and in Japan. In Japan, they actually break the law by not going on vacation. And they do break the law fairly frequently in Japan because they have less leisure time. They take less vacation time than we do. But in
with pay or without?
I think it's mandatory vacation with pay.
How much?
How much is the mandatory vacation? In some places 5 weeks, in some places 6 weeks, in some places four. None of them are as low as 2 to 3 weeks as what we normally get.
Is that through government intervention or just?
It's government, because otherwise you'd have companies competing against themselves, and these are nationally mandated vacations. You have to have that amount of vacation. They're simply written into the law. This is what you would need in a country like this to allow us to have that amount of vacation or that amount of leisure time, because if one company started giving 6 week vacations, they would be at a competitive disadvantage with other companies that wouldn't. Although I would even wonder about that. It seems to me it would be real attractive to work at a place where you had a 6 week vacation, and they might attract a higher quality of workforce.
Yeah, because most people only get 2 weeks, you're lucky if you work your way up to a month. And I've heard, like you say, it's a month to 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Many places.
Right. Except for college teachers who work 24 hours a day all the time, especially if you're doing American culture. I used to think I could deduct anything that I did. Do the business deduction, I could go to a movie and say, well, I'm studying American culture. I never did that, but I always thought that it would be possible to do it.
Having more leisure time seems to be significant, but back to what you were talking about earlier, our choices that we make, then with more leisure time, would we just watch more TV?
Yeah, right now we would watch more TV. You would need a kind of social infrastructure, a social conversation about what makes sense to people. Although, I mean, it may be that we wouldn't watch more TV. In fact, it is true that people are more depressed when they watch TV than at most times during the day. And yet we keep doing it, because I think just simply because it's so easy to watch TV. But we would need to develop the kind of infrastructure of, say, card playing that used to be there. My mother had a bridge club that met fairly regularly, and that was a kind of infrastructure of conversation and playing that can tend to get lost when people get, we have two career households and people are getting real busy. David?
I got a copy of my grandfather's college yearbook, and at Concordia Teachers College in Newport Forest, and they used to have a classical music listening club where some people had banded together and bought a phonograph, and they would get together and listen communally to music. But now we all have stereos in our houses, so we don't need to get together. And on top of that, we have the Walkman type thing, so we don't even have to listen with the people that are in our family together. So we're increasingly doing those things a lot.
Or with televisions now, we are now averaging more than two televisions per household. I've had students for years do a project where I asked them to essentially map out where all the televisions are in their house, and then to show the arrangement of furniture in the room that the television is in. And any anthropologist coming into an American home would be sure that we worship these things, because all of the furniture is arranged so that this is the center of attention. And I had one student who had, in a family of four, 10 televisions. I thought, wow, this is the American way.
Give me thoughts on the work environment, how we're going to deal with the stress of the decreasing time aspects and also the increasing amount of information. Like, if you look back just in the last few years, we used to have maybe 3 days to respond to a letter, and then it was FedEx, we had 2 days. Now we have CC mail, and people want answers in 20 minutes. And also the amount of information that's flowing through those systems is phenomenal. So one, you have shorter turnaround time and more information flow.
I think these are the things that would need to be dealt with collectively. I think those things have, in my wife's case, they've ruined the practice of law because people would send a document and then they'd call up later in the send a 200-page document, call up later in the morning and say, did you read it? And she already had 3 weeks of work ahead of her before she could possibly get to that document. But the pressure was there because of those kinds of things. And again, it doesn't seem to me that individuals can solve that problem because it's a collective kind of problem. And it might be the companies, some things need to be answered quickly, but a lot of them don't. And there would have to be some way of identifying that and making it a sort of, again, a corporate policy or some kind of policy that would say people don't have to and ought not to respond to certain kinds of information quickly. I don't have a good answer to that. I work in history, which is slow. I don't have to worry about those deadlines quite so much.
Well, the same thing is true in engineering with everything going to computer-aided drafting. It's expected to have that done before you even have time to think it through to see if it would work or not. And no one has had the guts to say, no, we don't have it thought through to see if it'll work or not yet. It's like send them something because you have the ability to push a button and do it, right?
Yeah.
And I think it causes problems in a lot of things. You have to think things first.
I could imagine in my utopian dreams that some companies might begin to advertise for themselves, not in terms of sort of product claims and the social benefits that you'll get from buying this particular product, like women will collect around you if you're wearing this cologne or something like that, but in terms of the social benefits that they provide. In Minnesota, for example, Barb and I tend to shop more often than not at any of the Dayton Hudson stores because we know that they contribute 5% of their pre-tax profits to charities, which is an extremely high percentage in American corporate culture. And that seems to us to be a good thing. And so we patronize those stores because we think that is a good thing. And in general, we don't have that information about businesses that we do business with. And so if we went back to what I was talking about last time, David Orr asking for an honest accounting of things, we could ask corporations or people that we're going to be doing business with to give us an honest accounting of, you know, what's work like there? Is it any good? If the work is lousy at your place, why should I do business there? And we could begin to make consumer judgments on the basis of social policy. Now, I don't see this is going to happen fast, but it seems to me that it's something, it's the kind of considerations that I want people to begin to think about. There are publications like Shopping for a Better World that allow consumers to make those kinds of decisions about where, for example, Coca-Cola does business or something like that. Do they do business in South Africa and in what ways? We already have some information that allows us to do that, but to have it go more public and to have a more national conversation like that. And there's some inklings every once in a while in politics that sort of thing will happen. Hillary Clinton several years ago talked about the politics of meaning. And said that the most important thing for Americans is the meaning of their lives, and I think that she was right about that. I think that people are confused about the meaning of their lives right now and don't have much time to think about it either, and a politics that appealed to that would have an attraction to people. But there are a lot sort of easier and cheaper ways to sort of get people, which is, like saying no new taxes. Which doesn't tell you much about meanings at all, but has an appeal of a certain sort.
And just for an example, in the garment industry, with all the publicity about who's using sweatshops.
Yeah.
And that's really a conjunction of government and labor making that information public.
Right. And if those sorts of things happened regularly, I think people are basically good and would make informed kinds of decisions. But right now they don't get that kind of information, and what they get is a kind of information that gives you all kinds of extraneous information that you don't want to know, or information that invites you to act on your worst instincts. I think it's time to quit if we want to have dinner in this highly regulated society that we have.